I'm sorry if I'm not lie to you, if that's my own, you know, two cents, but...
Decent people lie, Richard.
Yeah, I know.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. In this corner, we have Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And knocked out in the other corner, we have Cassidy Robinson.
Oh, you think this is the end of the fight?
I think you're already knocked the fuck out.
Mama said knock you out.
Hello, Cool J. Quote LL Cool J at me. Starting off to a really good... You know, getting their foot right under us. So how was your week?
My week.
You usually ask me, I thought I'd ask you, instead of being...
Sure. My week has been bizarre and a little... I'm trying to get B-Road legal in Orange County. Mm-hmm. I've been living here for over 5 weeks, and I've been driving with expired plates for about 3 of those weeks. And expired everything.
Sure.
And I wanted to do it sooner. I'm not just like, you know, that lazy. I mean, I'm pretty lazy, but I'm not that lazy. But, because it's a big city and not Idaho, when you make phone appointments, the soonest I could get was like 2 weeks. So otherwise I would have to do a walk-in and wait in some hellish Dante's Inferno-like, line. So I made an appointment. Eventually went in, and turns out I basically couldn't do anything because I didn't have enough information. I have to have my parents sign a form and have them mail it back, and I have to have a...
Are you a minor still? Why do... I'm confused.
Because technically they bought the car for me.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which, now everyone thinking, listening to this, thinks that I'm, like, really privileged.
Oh, yeah, you are.
I mean, yeah, in that, like, mid-20-something single white male thing. But they got the car for me a long time ago, and I've just kind of been driving it. And my name is on it as well, as a co-owner or whatever. But it's a big, dumb legal disaster that I'm in the middle of right now, and I you know, FML.
No. Yeah, that's fair. I had similar problems when the tree fell on my car last year.
Ah, yes. Might remember the tree saga.
Yeah, the tree saga in my life. I'm still afraid of trees a little bit, so. Just being under them. Being next to them is okay. Yeah, I should. I know.
They are like one of the largest living things in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And when they fall on nearly, you, it's scary. Yeah.
We are not nearly afraid of them enough. I think M. Night Shyamalan had something going on with that idea.
Okay, now you just lost it right there. All credibility right out the fucking window.
What have you been up to? What's your you're the one who should be talking. You actually did something this week.
Yeah, I did a little bit of something. We went to Portland's biggest comic convention, the Rose City Comic Con. Mm-hmm. I volunteered for it and also had the opportunity to wander the floor and talk to different various artists and different people within the comic book field. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw your pictures.
Yeah, there was tons and tons of cosplay. Actually, a lot of it was really, really damn good. We also had a friend that was dressed as I'll announce it. So that our listeners that don't know, and you that don't know, specifically you, I had a friend that was dressed as Femme Shepherd, and from the popular video game series Mass Effect.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, one day you might
say Mass Effect.
Yeah, one day when it comes out as a movie, you might understand about it.
Yeah, so then I can be part of that.
Right.
I've watched people play it for longer than feature length.
It's a huge story-driven first-person shooter actioneer, you know, space adventure. It's one of the best I've ever played in video games, hands down. People's obsession with it really does make sense.
Are you all up in this GTA 5 business? Like, that's pretty much all anyone's talking about on Facebook right now.
No, I haven't played that series for a while. I'm sure it's cool or whatever, but I don't know. They seem a little sleazy sometimes, and I'm like,
Sometimes?
Okay, all the time. I mean, when I was a teenager and running over people and stuff like that, it, as graphics and story and everything else has developed more and more, it's just gotten increasingly more so. As when I was a teenager and the first, Grand Theft Auto 3 came out, it wasn't like, it was just like, some dudes shooting each other, and that was about it.
Yeah.
You could beat a hooker, and that's, you know, it got a lot of negative press, but it just kept going from there. And I mean, I don't have any problem with that, like, in film or anything, but just in video games, sometimes I feel weird about it because you're actually doing it, kind of. Like,
because you're an active participant, not a passive observer.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it depends.
There's actually, specifically this game, and it might just have to do with where the culture is right now. I don't know exactly, but specifically this game, there's been a lot of criticism against it as like, how many of these are going to come out and be as sexist as they've always been, while not even having the option to play as a girl.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me, and I'm sure they're not going to lose money on it.
No,
that might be another thing too. I've just never. Maybe that's what I don't like. That might be part of what I don't tap into, because
you really like to play as girls.
Sometimes.
Like, if that's not an option, you're like, F this game.
It depends. It depends on the game. No, I like having the option. I haven't always played a girl. I've played a girl before in a game.
Yeah, you have. A handheld video game.
I don't know what that means, but I'm telling my wife. You're gonna be in trouble.
How is Rose City going back to what we were talking about?
Instead of rambling on into other, it was good. It was, you know, it's always good to see. And there was a lot of people like I'd met there originally, and that I've talked to online or whatever. And so it's the first time I've seen them in a while. So it was good.
It's kind of interesting, you know, still being connected to everybody from back home. The big deal this lately is that this year Salt Lake City just had their first Comic-Con.
Sure.
And so we have all these little mini-cons popping up all over the country because San Diego has become so gigantic and so expensive and so impossible to get into unless you want to sit in an online queue for, you know, 24 hours and probably not get a ticket anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. What do you think? What do you think like is going to happen with the Comic-Con concept? Do you think it's just going to be basically all these little mini cons are going to kind of diffuse it, or do you think San Diego is still going to be like a big fat deal?
I think that depends. I think a lot of money is coming in right now, and a lot of eyes are on the comics industry, not necessarily comics, not the actual thing.
But
the properties, because of the films and stuff like that. So I'm not sure, because I mean, San Diego Comic-Con, while they still have little semblance of the actual medium of comics, they don't actually. I mean, a lot of people are there for the media. Even a lot of the top tier guys at the comic convention at Rose City were kind of like, it's kind of weird, you know. A lot of people are here and they like the stuff, but you know, they're more into whatever. So I think it's just a changing dynamic and some growing pains within the industry. It could go either way. I hope it swings the direction that they become a more viable and bigger thing and more people get into them, but we'll see.
Yeah. The show.
So, but the show itself, I thought was really good. The panels were really excellent. And I mean, I might be, you know, the staff that I worked with, they were all really great. And, I thought as a show coming into it, it was really fun. So.
Yeah. And you worked as staff this year again?
Yeah. Yeah. I volunteered some hours. And, cool. Yeah. I was mostly a human sign, and I directed people. So,
yeah, we have a WonderCon here. That's our mini con.
Okay.
And when that happens, I might be able to go. We'll see.
Oh, yeah. Well, you might be able to volunteer as well.
Maybe. Yeah.
You'll have to work for it.
I don't know if I want to, but maybe.
Fair enough. No, it's a lot of fun. So.
Cool. Well, that pretty much catches us up. Let's go ahead and get into our movie news. What do you have for us?
Well, specifically, one of the things that I think is kind of, I'm about half and half on. It was just recently announced that Neil Marshall from films like Dog Soldiers, Doomsday, Centurion, probably missing something else, but
The Descent.
The Descent. Yeah, that's a good one.
Bar none, his best movie.
Oh, really? Well,
I think so. Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to really sit down and think about that. Because I watch all of those films for different reasons. Like the three. Centurion, no. But the other three, I do.
Yeah.
Anyways. He's most likely going to be doing the remake of the Norwegian film Troll Hunter in English. So, for those people who haven't seen it, it was somewhere between cinematography and that live action stuff or whatever, found footage. There we go.
Yeah.
It was somewhere in between that. And it was this really, you know, it was essentially about this guy who would go out into the forest and make sure that trolls weren't, you know, going to be of a harm to humans and just,
yeah,
try to keep them under control.
Who's hired by the Norwegian governments to keep. Basically, he's like a park ranger.
Yes.
But for trolls, and he has to keep populations down and stuff like that. And it treats all of the absurd, pagan ancient beliefs in trolls as if it were real. That's the gimmick.
Well, the belief and, some of that stuff is really, it was actually quite interesting.
No, yeah. And the fact that they go there and they completely, you know, they don't leave anything out. I mean, they literally, you know, hunt for or smell the blood of Christians and they use that as a plot device, and that's really clever. I really like Troll Hunter a lot.
Well, it seems, yeah, it just seems almost kind of hokey when you say it. It's one of those films where you're like, blah, 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 and you're saying it, and it's like, oh, that sounds weird. But the actual film, I thought, it was really good. It kind of highlighted some interesting things.
Do you think that part of the reason it works is because it's not American? And I don't mean, or English speaking. I don't mean that in like because American filmmakers are stupid, but I mean it in like maybe that detachment of culture sort of allows more suspension of disbelief. Whereas if you try and just do that in like Minnesota or something, is it just going to go to hokey?
Right. You know, I don't know. I think it's, see, this is one of those ones where it comes down to is there's a lot of conjecture you can go to. I think Neil Marshall I think he's an excellent director. Especially in this kind of genre pieces.
Sure. So, well, that's his shtick. He rarely does things that, you know.
So do I think it can be adapted? And if they're like hunting trolls out in, you know, in Minnesota and Wisconsin and all that, It can work. It all comes down to the adaptation and how they actually do it.
Yeah.
In general, but then you also have the, you know, from foreign language film to, you know, English film. How's that going to work? So it could go either way, really.
Yeah. I would ask our audience, whoever listens, that If you haven't seen Troll Hunter, I think it's still on Netflix probably, go ahead and watch it because it's a lot of fun. It's really clever. The special effects are actually surprisingly good considering how low budget it is.
Yeah.
And it's, as ridiculous as, and high concept as the plot is, it actually plays it pretty seriously and it all kind of works. But it still has a sense of humor too.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. I think he has a lot to live up to. And for me, Neil Marshall's kind of hit or miss, but,
I've only disliked one of his films, really. So I don't even disliked. I just, it was just, like, actually I kind of like it was fine, but it was just kind of,
lackluster.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the first bit of news I have, we were joking after we were off air. We were just talking to each other. I asked you kind of nonchalantly, I said, do you think Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to be in the new Avatar movie? Because I was thinking, Arnold Schwarzenegger's like trying to have his comeback now. He's doing all these B movies. And he's, him and Cameron had such a working relationship for so many years doing both Terminators and True Lies together. So it's like, wouldn't it be kind of great if he had a part in the new Avatar movie? Even though I don't really care all that much about Avatar, it'd be the one thing I could kind of get excited about. Well, it has just been announced that Arnold Schwarzenegger will reunite with James Cameron for Avatar 2.
How do you feel about that? I should really, you know, does that make your heart happy? Or are you just kind of like, yes? Or do you feel like prophetic?
Prescient, all of the above. All of the above. I think I'm I'm a soothsayer.
Oh.
No, I mean, it obviously, I asked that question because it's something that I think could or should happen, and it did. I don't really care about Avatar. I've had, you know, when I saw it in theater the first time, I liked it enough, and then I never really felt like I had to see it ever again.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a sequel. I think there's already, like, two sequels in the makes.
Something about underwater villages or something, I don't know. I've heard random rumblings, and I know he's trying to get, like, the special effects all together and stuff like that, which is fine.
Because that's 90% of the reason for it.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger could be fun in this kind of material, depending on what he does. I just hope that it's less moralistic, green, environmental blah. Like, let it be big, dumb space pulp fun. It could actually, like, tear a page out of the Riddick series book.
Sure.
And quit trying to be, you know, all of this heavy import that it can't really pull off anyway.
Well, I mean, especially if he's gonna... I think it was fine, but it just... personally, I pretty much agree with you. I'm not, like, upset with him for doing, you know, Ferngully in space, but...
Yeah.
But it did give it a little tinge of being a little...
to be about something?
Well, yeah. He tried to make it about something, but, I mean, you know, Terminator was a well-crafted movie, but...
Yeah.
I don't really feel like it was about too much.
I guess
maybe like mommy daddy issue kind of stuff, but
I wrote a whole article about James Cameron when he re-released Titanic in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that that's kind of that, you know, Titanic was kind of, even though it wasn't made for 3D, it was always sort of made for 3D because that's James Cameron. James Cameron's sensibility is he's more of a poppier, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of populist, filmmaker. And
sure.
He makes special effects films. And he makes, you know, sometimes he makes really good special effects films. I think Terminator 2, for my money, still stands as his best movie. And I think when he's working in sci-fi, he tends to kind of, that's a little bit more where he's free to do the type of movies he wants to do. And he can, I don't know, I think there's a decent amount of, like, you know, nuclear proliferation and fear of technology and all that kind of basic sci-fi stuff that's in there for the Terminator movies. But I don't know. Hopefully the introduction of Arnold Schwarzenegger into the Avatar series kind of knocks it off of its pedestal a little
bit. Well, I thought that they also said he's being approached as the new villain. for the movie.
So, oh, okay. So he's probably going to be some. Yeah, he's probably going to be some like cigar chewing industrialist trying to destroy whatever water planet.
Well, I think it's the same planet, just underwater. I don't know. I think that's. I think that makes it slightly amusing.
Yeah.
That he would be, you know, a politician in the film, a villain. I don't know if that's even going to happen, really, but I think it's slightly amusing.
What's your other news story?
My other news story is about the upcoming Warcraft movie.
Mm-hmm.
They've recently started announcing some of the could-be candidates for the film. One of those would be Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume, I mean, maybe he's, you know, I guess he did go ugly in Horrible Bosses, but I was like, I don't think he'll be an orc, but I don't know. Maybe he will be.
You never know. He's not above it.
No, I don't think he is.
And Paula Patton?
Paula Patton, yeah. I didn't know much about her, so what's her story? Do you know much about her?
I'm looking it up. Keep talking.
but essentially, that's who they're. Those are some of the candidates for some of the lead roles. I also recently saw another article where they were talking about some other possibilities, such as Paul Dano, Anton Yelchin, Travis Fimmel, and Anson Mount. The latter two I don't know much about.
Paula Patton was the chick in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. She was in Deja Vu. She was in Precious. She's been around.
Oh, cool.
She actually has a very Zoe Saldana kind of look.
Yeah, I noticed that. I just didn't know much about her.
Yeah.
So, and I was trying, I wanted to get this other,
yeah, obviously we're a little bit more, we're a little bit more curious about Colin Farrell's involvement.
Sure. Well, not just Colin Farrell, also, I think, you know, people like Paul Dano and Anton Yelchin, those are kind of cool, you know,
yeah,
actors that would be of interest. I don't know what they would pull. What I want to know is I've heard they're going to maybe some of the very first material. And if they're just, are they going to have all these other races that they've introduced in the games later? Or is it just going to be more like the first where it was humans and orcs? So, and I mean, are we going to have, like I said, I would like to see Colin Farrell as an orc a little bit. That would be kind of strange and fun. Sure. But I mean, at the same time, you know, some of these other, the stringier actors like Paul Dano and Anton Yelchin, right, they're kind of thin and elf-like. So are we going into that kind, are we going into that realm as well? So, so I don't know.
You know, I like Duncan Jones a lot in Moon and Source Code.
Sure.
I really want to see him succeed. I really want to see him, you know, get a big financial boost from something like this so that he can kind of make the movies he wants to make. I just can't get excited about this movie. The more I read about it, and it, not even just the more I read about it, but just the idea of like, some other gigantic fantasy movie with orcs and elves and ancient this or that. I just can't care.
I think it's all going to depend on, I'm just like hitting this side of the horse, but I disagree with you today on this cause. And this is why you're going to get knocked the fuck out.
Okay.
I want to see that. It's all in the adaptation. And I liked his attitude going into it. He's like, you know, I heard, you know, we talked about this way back in like one of the first episodes, and he basically, his attitude towards it was, he's can't make a good video game movie, challenge accepted. And I was like, I like that. So I hope he tries to raise it. And yeah, I think he's a person, he's a young filmmaker or a fairly young filmmaker that I think has something to say and who could elevate the material.
Yeah, and he's still hungry, you know, this isn't a cynical move. I think he, at this point in his career, he still wants to, and still needs to, make a name for himself, so he can't really afford a big flop.
I think he can.
I just don't know why this material.
I know he said he's played it in his younger college years, so that's why. I think video games is there's kind of, you're an old man, and you have this old man notion that that video games are a certain way, but they're much bigger, and they're becoming more and more complex and more and more profound. And so
it's not even the video game thing that bothers me, though. It's the fantasy.
It's the knockoff elves, Tolkien.
Yeah, the Tolkien-esque stuff. And it's like we have two more Hobbit movies that are going to be forever long.
In general, I agree with that sentiment. Yeah, very, very much so. We also have like Seventh Son and a few other things that are trickling out. However, I said that same thing, and then Game of Thrones has come out, and I've started reading those, and they're excellent. And he straight up says, and he's George R. R. Martin just straight up says, "Yeah, I'm influenced by Tolkien." Well, and you know what?
Who isn't?
But you know what? It works. He's created a great world and interesting. But it's not about what it comes down to is if they're focusing on, oh, this is an elf, and if it's stereotypical versus they have like some other element introduced to it.
Yeah.
Personally, I think he will do that, and we'll see. I remember playing the Warcraft games when I was younger, but I'm not as familiar with the world. So we'll see. It could be rather complex, or it could, you know, or you're right. I hope it's, but I'm not hoping
it sucks.
I think you are.
No, I really hope that he proves me wrong here, that, you know, he ends up finding something in this and still has a distinct voice in all of it, but I just doubt it.
We'll see. That's all I can say.
Fair enough. My last news article is, screenwriter Robert Towne is joining the staff of Mad Men for their last season. Robert Towne being the writer of Chinatown and Shampoo, and a lot of other movies during the 70s. He's fairly prolific. Did he do Five Easy Pieces? No, I don't think he did. He did The Last Detail, Days of Thunder. I was kind of thinking back about this when I heard about it, and I said, you know, if you look at Mad Men as a show, and you watch it, and you follow it, kind of the tone of that show is kind of very Robert Towne-esque. So it sort of could be a marriage made in heaven. I mean, I don't know exactly what he's there to do. Maybe just be a script supervisor, and he's just kind of there to pick up some money, and people are making a bigger deal out of this than it is. Or if he's really going to have a big influence on the last season. But I kind of think, like, you know, like the guy who did Chinatown writing for Mad Men, it works in my head.
Well, the other half of that, too, is as it's been following the, I just thought of this as you were talking, because he did do a lot of his prolific and I would say his best work, not all of his work, but truly great work in the 70s.
Yeah.
So that show itself, part of what makes it really interesting is the time capsule of what it is.
Yeah.
Is seeing, you know, the American dream like almost exposed throughout these different generations. And so if it's exposed into, you know, so we've spilled over from the 50s to the 60s. And now if we spill over into the 70s, that's, you know, that's bringing us right into that, you know, Chinatown and that kind of stuff era. So I'm personally, for me, that's very interesting that they would bring him on at this point. As it's getting closer and closer to the 70s. So I think it's a very smart move. And like I said, it could be, you know, it could be a gimmick, but I don't think so. The show's been too good for me to think that.
I don't think that they would make a choice like that and not have an idea what they were doing with it. Now, obviously, Matthew Weiner and all of the people who work on it, they know where the show's going. It's not like Town can come in and, you know, say, okay, here's my tablet of ideas and we all have to do them. He's going to be a staff writer. So they're going to have their trajectory for where the plot's going. But I'm sure he can inform characters maybe in an interesting way, maybe do dialogue in a different way. I don't know. But I think it could be a good collaboration.
Agreed. I thought it was fairly exciting, so.
Yeah. Alright, cool. Well, your turn for the pet topic, and I will let you ask me what you are going to ask me.
Okay. I'm a little afraid because I'm worried that this is like a question I've already asked, but hopefully there's nobody that's listening to us forever.
If it is, I'll try and answer it a different way.
Yeah. So, in film, is film's goal to project reality?
To project reality?
Yeah. Is it to show reality completely? Because there's that idea out there that that film's only place is to show realism.
Yeah, actually, it's very, very similar to the arguments given by the Russian filmmakers of the early period that I've been learning about in class just recently. And a lot of their theory has to do with that, that film is, you know, to be used as a social medium, as a learning tool.
Right.
I don't think so. I kind of come more from a, I think as soon, I sort of have like the Videodrome mentality when it comes to the medium of film and television and even the internet. Once you capture something, it ceases to be real. It's a document, but it immediately has a creative purpose as soon as you document it. And so even if you're using it as a learning tool or you're doing a documentary or something like that, it has to be edited in a certain way. It has to be,
or you propaganda. Know, we could also add that to the list.
Yeah. That's a, sometimes all in the same thing, but
agreed.
But I mean, even if your intention is to portray reality, even in something like a really realistic film, like the neorealists of Italy or like the Dogma 95 people or whatever.
Sure.
The act of filming something, it makes whatever you're filming become a type of fantasy. It's no longer real. It becomes maybe ultra real.
Yeah. Well, the film that we're going to be reviewing later, Prisoners, got me thinking about this.
Okay.
And I'll go into that more in our thing, but something that's been coming up a lot, and it's a word I've been hearing in some of the the comic workshops and stuff, is the idea of plausibility.
Yes.
In stories, which I think is a better route to go. And honestly, not just plausibility, but also just like, if you're not intrigued by some part of it, then why do you care? And to me, sometimes those genre elements can really, you know, they get your little imagination running on their heels. So,
yeah.
I think that there's also hints of that in realistic films that that sometimes elevate them.
I think that has more to do with intention.
Sure.
You know, what is your goal and intention with the piece, with the film? Do you want to really put the audience in some sort of emotional or psychological state, and if that's the case, then you can do so with whatever means possible. You know, fantasy, horror, sci-fi, whatever, they all kind of bend plausibility to be able to play in those kind of rules. So that's why genre film is genre film.
Sure.
But if your goal and intention is realism, then genre should be something you should be very aware of if you don't want to take people out of the story.
Well, you don't want to make it a stumbling block either.
You don't want to evoke something you didn't mean to.
Yeah.
Correct. Which is weird or hard to think about nowadays because genre, you know, all of those genres, whether you're talking about horror, sci-fi, melodrama, western, all of those kind of pat formulas are so well worn and so just part of the cultural milieu that it's hard to avoid them. It's hard to even recognize them now because there's been so much genre crossing and blending over the years.
And I think that that's going to continue.
Yeah.
Especially now, you know, we've done a lot of reflecting on this subject already, but with all the sequels and stuff like that,
yeah.
And remakes and the such that's coming out. It does kind of make you think because where film comes out a lot quicker than say novels, you know, mm-hmm. novels, you know, they sometimes, a lot of those have the same problems, you know, but I mean, it all comes down to influences.
Yeah.
So I think it's a line. Reality to me is a line, but if you can enhance it through evocative imagery, stuff like that, I think it can elevate a film.
Yeah.
Even if it's realistic, I'm not, take a movie like we already were talking about this, so let's go into Chinatown. Mm-hmm. You know, the imagery of that film, where its setting and stuff like that, wasn't in these fantasy realms.
No.
However,
I mean, it was a period piece.
It was a period piece, but it also, there was an almost, at times there was almost a strange, strange atmosphere.
Yeah.
And they wrote a thin line.
Well, it was a noir.
Yeah. And I mean, even the ending specifically, yeah, I guess, well, there you go. It was kind of it gets into a little bit of maybe a crime drama thing. So.
Yeah. It's really trying to evoke the kind of hard-boiled fiction from the 30s and the film noirs of the 40s and 50s, and it's trying to do so in kind of a modern contextualization in that, you know, yeah. Robert Towne, 70s nihilistic socialism, or not socialism, but social critique, those type of films that were made in America at that time. And it was kind of a blending of the two, but I think it does so quite consciously.
Agreed. But I mean, I think it's still kind of, you know, it's still, it hurts that line. And I think it elevates it by doing so.
Mm-hmm.
By accepting those parts, the hard-boiled detective kind of thing. I mean, it kind of subverts the, you know, because he becomes so inept and we've,
yeah.
You even mentioned how it made, and I'm sure you stole this from somewhere, but that's what we do. But you told me about how he probably made the situation worse.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't rip that off of anything in particular. That's what, Robert Towne and Polanski said about the character is that,
oh, so you ripped it off from them. Gotcha.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the commentary, the documentary footage in the movie, if you watch it, the behind-the-scenes footage, said that he got the idea from knowing a cop who worked in Chinatown. And he said that, you know, the languages are so broad and the crime is so prevalent that the best thing you can do is nothing, because if you get involved, chances are you're going to make it worse without even realizing it. And that's where he got the idea to write. Yeah.
That's awesome. I think this is the one we agree on, and I didn't want to get too in depth, but I guess it just wax a little poetically. I don't know what the hell this was about, but.
Well, sure. I think it leads into our review for Prisoners exactly. quite well. Cause you're really hitting something right on where I'm coming from with this movie. So, we can go ahead and start our review for Prisoners.
Okay.
This is a film, a thriller of sorts, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman, as well as Maria Bello, Viola Davis, and Terrence Howard, and what's his face? Paul Dano, who we were just talking about. And the basic plot of this story is we're in kind of, you know, middle of winter, cold, slushy, kind of moody atmosphere going on. There's couple families having a holiday dinner. I think it takes place during Thanksgiving, or at least starts in, during Thanksgiving. And you have Terrence Howard and Viola Davis hanging out with Hugh Jackman and Maria Bello as they have a few kids that are kind of running around and misbehaving. And they run outside and everyone's kind of having fun and drinking and playing piano. And then all of a sudden, it's, where's the kids? Well, turns out nobody knows. And a hunt goes on to find where the kids are and who took them. Their lead suspect is kind of a mentally handicapped man played by Paul Dano, who was seen in a RV which was parked outside of their house during the time of the disappearances, and when approached by Jake Gyllenhaal and the other police officers, he even takes off, which makes him look even more guilty. But during questioning, he denies everything. There's no real plausible evidence in the RV. He's able to be let go, and Hugh Jackman, a gun-crazy survivalist, decides to take the law into his own hands and kidnaps the presumed kidnapper and starts to try and get the information his own way.
Yeah.
Well, that's just the ice cap of where
really
the
is.
Story goes.
I personally think that the more that's left, about the trailer, one thing I liked but didn't like about the trailer, was not intriguing, and I thought made the movie look bad. However, it did not
give it away.
Did not give anything away. And so that's what I really like. This film, to me, evoked things like Night of the Hunter.
Okay. That's an interesting comparison, actually.
M, I think a little bit.
I did see that.
They use smoke in one of the camper scenes and just up through the trees, all that kind of thing. And even modern day things like, you know, Seven. To a slighter degree. The one that I was most heavily drawn, you know, in comparison to was Night of the Hunter. And that is a great fucking film. And so, so it's a good place to go from. I think what this film does completely right is that it skirts on the edge of using image evocatively. And maybe it's not realistic, but it evokes something. He's using symbols to really get things out. And it's really interesting. There are a lot of religious elements in here that are super intriguing.
Yeah.
And these religious elements, for me at least, what it did is it really asked a lot of questions, and but it didn't give any answers. And I think that's what's very successful about this film. And I like that all the questions it raises during it, in this manhunt.
I mean, it obviously it talks a lot about morality and a lot about justice and what is justice and what is morality and how do you distinguish the two.
I think it does it without getting on its soapbox and being like, well, these are the bad guys, these are the good guys, and these are this, you know, like we were talking about Avatar earlier, which I think strangely kind of ties in. It didn't get up on the, you know, film doesn't. It asks questions and is like, you know, because I've heard several parents that say, yeah, I'd kill for my kids.
Yeah.
And it's heart-wrenching. Because this film has some extreme scenes that really have to kind of play into that ethos. Uh-huh. And I mean, it also plays in, you know, it plays in those mommy issues, like something like Psycho or something like that.
Yeah.
So
that's very true.
I think it's in a long lineage of films that have to do with a lot of those different things. And I think that it's very successful. And some of the imagery, again, there's some of the cinematography, some of the writing, some of the directing was done very, very well. And
some of the acting.
Acting was great.
Yeah.
I thought, personally, Hugh Jackman was a better Wolverine in this movie than he has in any of the...
True. He definitely shows a lot more enthusiasm for this material.
And he's a lot more angry, too.
Yeah.
So, Viola Davis was a small part, but Jake Gyllenhaal, actually, you know, I was really like, oh gosh, he's playing a cop again. Mm-hmm. But he plays this detective, and he's got these almost like, what's his face? He was in M, the famous and the Big Sleep.
Peter Lorre?
Peter Lorre. He has little twitches. He kind of does that kind of thing, but he does it with his eyes.
Yeah, I actually wasn't crazy about that acting choice.
Really?
I thought it drew too much attention to itself. It felt too much like an acting choice.
No. To me, I thought it was, to me, because of all the other films that I felt it evoked, I felt that it was reminiscent of those.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the equivalent of Jack Nicholson's Band-Aid on his nose.
Yeah. I liked that.
Yeah.
I also thought what was interesting about his name was the pagan stuff that came up with Loki, and he had all the Aquarius symbols. And I wasn't sure if his ring was Freemasonry. I couldn't see it very well. I'd have to get a better look at it. But so that interplay with all the Christianity and or the Catholicism. But anyways, all of those things, all of those mixtures, the snakes and scenes, everything, you know, provocative, just, you know, study into when these kind of things happen, when children go missing.
Yeah.
You know, who's culpable?
Your argument is that it's specifically that there is a fantasy element here that is purposeful.
Yeah. Agreed.
And that it, in a Night of the Hunter sort of way. And it sort of becomes sort of a fairy tale, a dark fairy tale.
I think in a lot of ways it is, yeah.
With the snakes and everything.
Well, I think that it's a big bad wolf tale, but it's a cautionary to who that big bad wolf
is. Yeah. Or could be,
yeah.
That's really interesting. And you're kind of making me like the movie more. Well, no, yeah. Really, honestly. I liked it okay. I liked the first half a lot more than I liked the second half. My issues with the movie, I think that it does all those things you're saying, and it does all those quite well, and I do think it looks really, really good. I think it's really well made. It's really well directed. I should actually call out that director's name. Denis Villeneuve. It's French.
Okay.
I'm seeing maybe what else he's done. Encendies. Yeah, so he's a French director. And he has a really great eye. The movie looks great. I think the performances are really good, except for the blinking, which I wasn't crazy about. But other than that, I think that, you know, everyone's on their top of their game. I mean, Paul Dano's kind of doing that, like, intense, almost kind of Sean Penn-ish type intensity that he always does in every movie, but it's used to a purpose. My issues with this is that as the movie progresses, and in your argument, you see this as a positive, and maybe it is, I feel as though the more and more the movie progresses, the less and less plausible everything seems, and more it kind of delves into genre territory, into kind of B-movie territory, and into kind of pulpy fodder. I think it starts to overplay the red herrings pretty fast. And all this, you know, I mean, about every like 20 or so minutes, they introduce, well, maybe this person's a suspect, or maybe it's actually this. And then by the end of the movie, it starts to triple twist on itself. And I didn't feel as though the reveal was all that satisfying for given how much attention was given towards finding that reveal.
Well, I think, and to me, it played on some of those ideas, because the misnomer about, killers and people who do crimes like this is that they always work alone, and they're always this, you know, this dude out in the woods, and he's gonna fuck shit up and stuff like that, and he's kind of a weirdo, and, and that's kind of what I liked about it, is that, maybe it's the editing or maybe it's the pacing, but something about the film kind of drags a little.
Well, I think it's definitely a slower paced movie. I think it has a lot to do with the tone. I think it has a lot to do with the kind of movie it is. The movies it reminded me of.
Well, I don't mind that it's slow. That's not the thing. There's something that specifically happened with the pacing that,
it might be a little erratic.
Not even erratic. I feel like it's a little, it's not snappy enough, or it's not sharp enough, or maybe like, maybe it is, maybe part of that is the red herrings, but I tend not to think that, but no, I think it evokes a very different, I don't think it's your run of the mill with the evocative imagery and all of the little, religious hints and stuff like that. I don't think it's your run of the mill, you know, somebody did something, we're going to find them kind of movie. I think that it's a different kind of thing that's asking a lot of questions. I think also it's kind of interesting. I don't know, maybe this is just in my head, but I almost felt like there was some, post 9/11 kind of stuff happening. And maybe it's just the current atmosphere, but, Hugh Jackman seemed very conservative. Whereas the Howards, I'm going to call them, I can't remember the, you know, that family seemed, maybe a little less, very polarized. And it seems like kind of slice of America kind of almost.
Yeah. I do think there is a political subtext here that's going on beyond all of the child stealing stuff.
Cause there's a lot of, cause of all of the economic stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, more so specifically, I think that Jackman is the survivalist gun nut type of guy, and that I think they're trying to say something about sort of that sensibility. And that he jumps to the gun and this, you know, we're going to, you can even say almost a Zimmerman-esque kind of mentality. Stand your ground and all that stuff.
I agreed. And that's, and I mean, again, this is one of those films where we've been talking about this year that we're like, oh, this is strange that it kind of has, undertones to things that are happening, even though it was made way before that. However, I do think that that's.
I think it's a really ambitious movie.
Yeah.
And I think that it's trying to do a lot of things. I don't think it accomplishes all of those things. And I think a large part of that is because it is overreaching. I think it is trying to be too many things at once. And I think that the movie, the strongest elements of the movie, which is, you know, this, the major theme here of the hunter being hunted and you know, what is morality and all of those kind of things, gets a little, diffused by all of the red herrings and all of the subplots that come in here and all of the, you know, I had a hard time kind of trying to put together the logic of this film of, okay, so-and-so kidnapped so-and-so at this time, but how many years passed and then what do they not remember? What's going on?
No, I didn't have any issues with that personally.
I just thought the likelihood of some of these things were a little hard to swallow. And by the end of the movie, I felt like it was a really well-made B movie, but kind of a B movie.
I disagree. I feel like it elevated the material. He used a lot of, it runs in a vein of very similar films. Maybe not as big, but I think that there's a lot of subtext and a lot of stuff going on there that kind of elevates it and makes it a bigger and a better movie than somebody else making it. I think that it's not just a whodunit. I don't think that's even what the movie's about.
You might be correct.
I think you're wrong. Straight up.
It might be worth looking at again, seeing it under different goggles. But as the movie was going, I felt like it started out very promising, and then the movie just kind of became sillier and sillier and more histrionic, it felt like it was kind of riffing.
It's weird
on,
to me that you couldn't follow the logic of it, because to me it was like beep beep beep. I just felt it was a little slow at times, and to me it was some, I don't know what it was exactly. I'd probably have to really take a look at it, and so it definitely wouldn't be on a first viewing to see something like that.
Mm.
But do I think that this is interesting and interesting to watch among other movies like it? Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Very much so. And do I think it's better than some run-of-the-mill B movie that comes out? Hell yeah. It's a lot better than that. And I think that people with interest in a film, with interest in the films that I've previously mentioned, I think that there is a strand that runs with all those.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're wrong. Your assessment is wrong. So.
I mean, it's hard to really get into specific complaints without ruining things. So, but there was just a lot of like twists and turns.
We'll argue later.
I'm sure we will. There was a lot of twists and turns towards the end of the movie where they seem like they were only happening because the plot wanted them to.
I thought it was specific. I thought it was very specific, and there was some very specific wording. So, but keep going.
Yeah. And then a lot at some specific beats of the movie I felt was really familiar and not were trying to be part of a grand tradition of this type of movie, but just kind of ripping it off. Like I felt a lot of Zodiac in there, and I felt a lot of especially the last act. I felt a lot of Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, and I was okay with that. I think that those are also films within that vein of films that I've already talked about. And I think that those films came way after all those other films. So to be, I don't know, I think this is a film in a line of a conversation. I don't think that it's directly ripping it off.
Mm. I do think it's worth seeing, though. Despite my complaints, despite the fact that I'm not even...
Despite
the fact that I'm wrong.
Thank you for saying it.
I do think it is worth seeing... Specifically because of the performances, specifically because of the studied direction, I do think it is a notch grade above the types of movies that could be lumped in with this kind of movie. But for me, it kind of misses the mark. It's almost there, and it's just shy of becoming something better. It kind of gets in the way of itself by delving headfirst into genre territory.
No, you're wrong. Okay. Again, I'm sorry. I think that we would probably disagree
on this one.
I think that with a further, I think by looking at it a little, going back to it, and I mean, some of the stuff I think that is very subtle, but I think it's very good, and I think it's very purposeful and well used. So. Yeah.
Okay, I'll give away one thing. It's not really a thing, and it's not even really giving anything away. Spoiler alert, maybe. What do you make of all the priest business?
The priest?
Yeah, what was his deal?
He was hiding bodies for people.
Is that what that was?
And he was, there's a big thing of, alcoholism.
Yeah, no,
He was on the list of, I'm going to visit three people convicted of being child molesters.
Yeah, yeah, he was,
number three.
Okay. I just thought that was a random red herring that never got resolved.
No, he was just, you know, and so he became the one that let out another clue towards, you know. And the other thing that I liked about it is instead of giving you like these, either giving you too scanty details or too, you know, they did give you details, but they gave you more realistic details. When there is a manhunt, you don't, you know, you get to search, you know, the entire area that you're mm-hmm. in, not just, we've got three people we're looking at. So.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, there's Prisoners, yeah. Which is kind of, might be the kickoff of, you know, the post dump month garbage section of the year.
So you mean, I think at the end where summer's dumped off all the blockbusters.
Yeah.
And we're starting to climb out of the heap into Oscar season. Is that?
Yeah. I think we're is stuff of a little bit more higher minded material might start to come out for. And also, I think this might segue a little bit into the Halloween season as well.
Oh, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, cool. We'll end our show with our last segment, as we always do, the Netflix homework, which you assigned me last week, mm-hmm. is the film The Other F Word. How about you describe that?
Okay, basically this is a documentary about random people that were either influenced by punk, influenced punk, or were or part of the punk scene for a long time. Mm-hmm. And basically them moving from having to be the ultimate adolescents, you know, to basically moving into the role as father figures or being fathers. And some of them to more success than others or whatever, but some of them to complete success. It mostly followed the lead singer from the band Pennywise.
Yeah.
And his dilemma. So it became this kind of, you know, two worlds colliding and what's the better one? Which is kind of funny because there is such an, it was great for me to watch this kind of, I've always listened to a lot of punk music and I've always, and I deeply appreciate it. And it has a lot of the philosophy and a lot of the things that come from that music scene have really sunk deep into me and are part of me as a person. Mm-hmm. However, I've always been very hesitant about certain threads and certain complete nihilistic and complete throw yourself into, you know, everything fucking sucks and it's all horrible all the time. And like, I've always had a problem with some of kind of that, with certain parts of that. Like, and specifically, I think this kind of addresses it. And I actually really, really enjoyed seeing some of these guys like as dads. It was very, very amusing to see, you know, like the dude from Rancid and all that.
Yeah.
You know, taking his kid to the bar.
It was a forehead tattoo, yeah.
Forehead tattoo, his hair's dyed leopard pattern, you know, he's got piercing the whole nine yards, you know.
Yeah.
And it was touching, you know. I almost, you know, sometimes it's good to watch a documentary and just have a good, nice, heartfelt documentary instead of, you know, something that rips you apart and later you learn the facts weren't true. Whereas this, you don't really have to worry if, you know, it's kind of more of an opinion piece. But it kind of, at the same time, kind of talks about, talks about something. So I mean,
they describe it as the coming of middle age story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did I enjoy this? Yeah, I thought, I thought it was interesting. And I would feel that somebody even, I actually think that a lot of people who, are not into punk rock would actually appreciate this more than somebody who does, just because I could, from what I can tell and from what I've kind of observed, there's a lot of people arguing, oh, well, this guy isn't punk and he's not cool and this band sucks. And it's like, that's really not the point, guys. Just shut up. Shut up and go into your own little dark, dingy hole and shut the fuck up. But, I mean, it also, I guess, kind of confronts what is, you know, what is this, you know, fatherhood thing. And uh-huh. I don't know. I liked it. What about you?
Yeah, it was okay. I eventually, like, I think when it first started and it first kind of came up, it felt a little kind of MTV-ish. And what I don't mean that in, like, sell out or whatever, but I meant it's like the way it's edited, it's kind of quickly edited, there was a lot of music and it felt like a little bit, it kind of felt a little fluffy at first. I had a hard time trying to find out what the point to all this was, other than to show, you know, punk rockers can be decent people too, which I'm not so close-minded that I would think that that would be an impossibility, so I kind of felt like maybe I'm not the one who's being preached at. But as the movie goes and as it progresses and as it enters these different stories, especially as you start to get a fuller realized sense of the narrative spine being, you know, the lead singer Pennywise and his struggle and these other stories kind of tangentially supporting that one, either, you know, seeing how do these guys kind of do not just the punk rock thing but just a rock and roll lifestyle in general, as well as, you know, be capable fathers. And I think what really kind of brought me around to liking this and it kind of gave it a little bit more heft is when they started talking about their own childhoods, when they started talking about the way they were raised and how, you know, part of the reason they became punk rockers, or part of the reason they decided they were anti-authority is because the first authority figures in their lives, their parents, failed them. And so you have this interesting construction where they become punk rockers as teenagers because they had no parents, but then they become parents, so they want to be better parents, and they're becoming the authority figure that they were there at one point against, but they want to do it better than the way, for the reason they became the thing they became. Like, I thought that was interesting, and there's some really great moments, some really great documentary, you know, pieces in there, like where Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the way he talks about his daughter and their relationship is really, really quite heartwarming and moving. And Art Alexakis from Everclear talking about his childhood and all of these guys and all of their different stories. I think it is. I wouldn't say that it's a must watch. I think you do have to have some sort of interest either in punk rock or in these artists in general, or just rock and roll documentaries or parenthood, whatever. I think you have to have some kind of way into this. I don't think it's for the uninitiated. But I think it's totally enjoyable.
That's the only point I disagreed with you. I thought that maybe there was a little bit, it did seem a little like, oh, we're showing random interviews from people at first. Or it feels like they should maybe have just, where they could have put in a lot of these interviews. So it essentially came down to maybe an editing problem, because at the first of the movie, it did have all these bits of like random interviews, and then it broke out into a narrative stream, where it should have started on a narrative stream, maybe introduce some of these more, and just kind of... It was a little messy at first.
It's kind of a difficult way to wrangle all this footage together, because they have to introduce all of your documentary characters first, and then be able to find the spine in there. And I think they do that. It just takes a while. For the first 40 minutes, I was like, okay, this kind of feels a little bit like MTV Cribs a little bit. But I'm waiting for a point to rise out of it, and it does. And I think
I didn't really get that out of it, but I don't know. I mean, I don't think that your criticism are necessarily completely off. I just think that it's an interesting statement for a broader range. Like I said, I think that there's the elitists of punk and stuff like that can go argue in their fucking caves on their computers about what it is or whatever, but
sure.
I think that the family element of the whole thing is interesting. I do think that it raises questions, and I think that you might be right that there might be some more standard clean living folk that have a hard time, because you know these parents do want to say the F word, they want to say F, they want to say fuck. And they want to do, you know, they have some of these former hangups, and, you know, they do have demons and whatever.
Chips
else
on their shoulders, yeah.
Yeah, but these people, of all people, these are the people who want to be good dads.
Yeah, they feel challenged to be better than they were, than their fathers were to them.
Yeah, and I think it's strange to me that the ultimate thing of rebellion becomes, I'm going to become a good dad. You know, that's what actually is the most interesting to me. But, not the most interesting, it's just an interesting tidbit. So you might be right. This might cater to people who actually have some interest in some of those things. But I think that it's a lovely message. And if people can't, you know, look past facade, then. And I think it was an interesting thing I liked hearing, there was the guy, the former skateboarder, whose son died. I forgot his name.
Oh, yeah. That was a pretty heart-wrenching story.
That one was rough, too. But I liked hearing his story, too. But I liked them talking about, some of those people talking about punk specifically. Uh-huh. I thought it was interesting, like, him talking about how a lot of it's a stage show and they're actors.
Yeah.
I liked that, because I think there's truth.
That was actually quite bold, especially like the lead singer Pennywise and even some of those other guys who'd been in the game for a long time. They're in the 40s now.
Yeah,
and they're talking
US
about
bombs. He was in the US bombs, that's what it was.
Yeah.
30 US bombs or something.
And they're talking about how, you know, a lot of the times when they're on these like 150-day tours and it is just an act. They just have to go up there and force themselves through it. And it's not all about like real down to the earth, you know, feeling the energy from the crowd. Sometimes it is work.
Yeah.
And that's really bold for someone in the punk rock world to say, because, you know, it's supposedly.
Well, I found it very interesting with him, but with him, with that right next to, you know, Fat Mike talking about his stage presence and stuff and where he gets that from.
Yeah.
Because he seemed a little different in his house with his daughter, as much as he says that he's not going to change. He seems a little bit, you know, and maybe, and that could be the lie of the documentary as well.
Yeah, yeah. They show what's going to be the most flattering.
Yeah.
Although I think it's actually pretty fair, especially towards him, Fat Mike, that, you know, they leave enough in there that you go, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that you're doing a stand-up job.
Yeah, right. That's fair. He did make her toast, which it was kind of weird, strangely adorable. But
yeah, he had an adorable kid. Yeah. But he should at least brush her hair before he takes her to school.
Probably. No, I mean, yeah, and I mean, it was cool to see like the original singer from Reyes from Black Flag. That was interesting to see his subline and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That subline. So I mean, there is a lot of stuff for just the rock historian, as you say. I think it does raise some questions. I also like what Brett Gurewitz from Epitaph was talking, one of the founders of Black Flag, where it was like, you know, this is just because, you know, punk people had a hard time getting out of their adolescence. You know.
Yeah.
I liked what he had to say, because I thought that it was very interesting, very poignant, you know. Punk has grown up. Sure, when it was in its infancy, and this is what it was, but, you know, it's going to change, plain and simple. So, I don't know. I really enjoyed kind of some of the commentary and just kind of hearing from the different minds from it. And then the weird jokes about Devo and then having the guy from Devo, like, kind of comment. I don't know.
Mark Mothersbaugh? Yeah.
I thought that was kind of fun, too, but... I mean, overall, I thought it was a good documentary, and I would recommend it to people. So,
cool. Well, next week I am going to assign to you Guy Madden's movie Keyhole. I believe this was the last movie he released. No, he's still alive, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
But I don't know if you've ever seen a Guy Madden movie. But if you haven't, this is it's an interesting guy.
Oh, I'm excited. This is either good or bad. I'm not sure yet.
Well, he has a very distinct style to his movies. But yeah, so we'll be doing that next week. And if anybody has any opinions about any of the things we talked about in this episode, Prisoners or the other F word or Keyhole, before we review it next week, you can get a hold of us through our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also get in contact to us through Facebook in our own fancy schmancy Facebook page, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there, and you can see whenever we have any updates about the show or delays that we want to announce before, or if you want to suggest Netflix homework that we may have not done in past episodes, or see any of the news items that we don't talk about in the show, that's a good place to find us. You can also listen to us on iTunes, subscribe to us there, and write us a review, leave us a star rating. Do all of those things. You can also just stream us directly from your computers at our Podbean archives, which is jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can also find our RSS feed if you want to subscribe through a different medium other than iTunes. You can read my weekly movie reviews at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. Where I post those weekly from the Idaho State Journal. You can also read my column on the MacGuffin podcast. I have nothing to do with their audio or video cast, but I do contribute content to them occasionally at mcguff.in. And Richard, you can find locked in a very, very small bathroom with the hot water turned all the way up.
Ow.
So who's been knocked out now?
Yeah, really, really. Okay, I see how we're doing this. Bye.
Bye.